Come on. Always since its inception.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I think if I heard the question correctly. Oh, Don Mitchell. In the back.
And your affiliation, please.
I guess I am answering Senator Fisher's question as a representative of AFN. And I believe the question was, how have rural hunting and fishing opportunities been affected by Tier 1 and Tier 2 in this new arrangement? And has that been a good or bad thing with respect to protecting those kinds of opportunities?
No. I want to ask it in much more narrower fashion. Does Tier 2 adequately protect the needs, the rights of rural, of bush Alaskans, regardless of Tier 1?
Well, obviously, if you use the three criteria and you lump everyone in the state, urban and rural alike, into the criteria, I think that you will find that when you get through all the confusion, that certainly the experience to date has been that way out at the end of the line, most of the people, most of the time, apparently seem to be getting those permits. I don't think that's the end of the discussion, however. I know that Representative Fuller, it's my understanding on the House side, is going to be holding some hearings that are going to go through the bush to answer just precisely that question, and that what he has been hearing from his constituents out there is that there are some real problems, particularly with the methodology that's being used to implement all this. To go into those villages and have to have every single household fill out a 10, 15-page detailed questionnaire to be asked information that is not really particularly relevant to their situation, apparently, according to Representative Fuller, has caused some very serious problems. So I don't think that it's, I think it's a little simplistic to just say, well, when the smoke clears, who's getting permits and who's not. I don't think that's a good thorough analysis of the policy consideration.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just follow up briefly. The problem, let's put it this way, if the problem appears with the implementation of the Supreme Court's Madison decision, do you see that giving the board proper authority, necessary authority, to regulate could then adequately take care of the essentially the Tier 2 protection set by the court?
Well, I think that is basically the thrust of some of the legislation that was before your body last session. If you think about it, in terms of what the problems are, in terms of what I've just identified and what you've heard from urban hunters, the problem is that the now infamous three criteria were originally intended to be used to discriminate between Alaskans who are living out in the bush. So those criteria are still, under the Tier 2 situation, being used to discriminate between them. And obviously they're coming out in it okay. They have problems, as Representative Fuller has indicated, with the fact that it's a logistical nightmare and it's very confusing and it's not working at an operational level, but I would grant you it is a problem with respect to how to apply criteria to those folks that were in effect prior to this Madison case. So that's one separate problem you have with this. However, then you have the second problem, which is you've got those same criteria that may be perfectly appropriate for use in the bush in a more benign fashion, now being applied to Alaskans that live in downtown Anchorage. And to say that you and I, who live, I think, I live in your district, so we don't live too far from each other, you know, to line the two of us up and start talking about which one of us has the greatest dependence on a particular caribou population.
I have a more traditional dependence.
You certainly, Senator, have an older defendants. But I mean, I think they're two real separate problems.
Mr. Chairman,
we're not getting into a debate on between you two, are we?
Not at all. No. I'll defer to him. He can have a caribou. what I was really trying to get at here is that the governor's bill essentially was designed to protect Tier 2 but do away with Tier 1. And part of my interest is to segregate these two issues, because Tier 2, it was, I think, the original intent of the law, and I don't think the Tier 2 protection was meant to be endangered by the court or by anyone. And what I'm trying to figure out is how to segregate the two and take care of Tier 1 without jeopardizing the urban hunters, who essentially have been enfranchised, who have been given full rights under the Madison decision. What I feel is we have to make that more workable.
Well, the irony of all of this is that while it may look as if urban hunters have been given full rights, what has actually happened is that they have been put way to the back of the line, because they basically have those rights determined on the basis of criteria
right.
that were never intended to be applied to urban hunters, and that certainly don't make any sense at all. And the trouble, I think, with this politically, of course, is that it only makes sense if, in fact, you start off thinking about what to do about this by realizing that how you're going to deal with the group of hunters that are living out in the bush may require a different approach.
Right.
From the kind of approach that would be needed to do basic fairness to people like you and I. But that requires standing up and saying, well, yes, it does make some public policy sense to, as a threshold matter, divide hunters into those two categories. And obviously there are people that feel very strongly that, regardless of the common sense involved in that, that it just, for a variety of reasons about which reasonable minds can differ, that it just isn't appropriate to do. And then you have the problem we now have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you much for your testimony. Mr. Bismarck. Did someone leave their bandana or something on the table? It's a blue one.
Somebody might have hit a mic resting.
Does it belong to anybody? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the invitation.
Would you spell your name, please?
My name is Fred Bismarck. I'm from Tyonic. And the invitation was a surprise to me, because I just come back from commercial fishing last night and opened my mail this morning over coffee, and I had to come into Anchorage to come to a meeting today. I'm not here to find a solution to subsistence, but I'm here to testify on what subsistence means to me. I'll go back in history. I was born and raised here in Anchorage. And during the Depression in 1929, we lost our home. We lost our home to taxes. We owed $150 taxes on our homes, and we couldn't come up with that money because they didn't have any jobs during the Depression. We moved out in the outlying areas, and we moved to Tyonic in 1929. We lived off the country. We lived off the country all our lives. Over 50 years have been in Tyonic. I don't know if it's the Lord's way of watching over us. In the olden days, there were a lot of grouse in that country. There were a lot of ptarmigans. There were a lot of rabbits, a lot of porcupines, a lot of beavers. There was no moose in that country. The moose didn't come into that country until in the 1940s, before the first moose ever come in. Nobody knows where they come from. I've asked the biologist, and the biologists don't know either. And before the moose come over, the people from Tyonic used to go over to the Kenai Peninsula, go up the Kenai River and the Kasilah River and hunt moose there. And they used to put up their meat like jerky, and that's the only moose meat we ever had all winter long. And subsistence means a lot to the people, my people in Tyonic, and a lot to everybody else. My wife and I, we raised 11 kids and about 4 grandchildren. We lived off subsistence all our life. Without subsistence, we'd never make it. We raised 11 kids, and never in my life have I been on welfare or food stamps. And that's something I'm proud of. But if they take subsistence away from us, they're going to take subsistence away from us, they're going to take our land away from us. We lose subsistence, we're going to lose our land. Somebody tell me, what percentage of Indians could pay their taxes on their land after 1991? We'll go back to in history. We lost ours for $150. Now, how many people, what percentage of the Indians are going to be able to keep their taxes up on their land? We're going to lose our subsistence. We're going to lose our land. We won't have nothing left. And I don't know what you can come up with. You got to come up with a solution of some kind. Because if the state don't come up with a solution, I'm afraid the federal government's going to step in and take over for the state. And I don't want somebody in Washington, D.C. telling me what I could eat and what I can't eat. And I don't like the state telling me that either, but I think you can get along better with the state than you can with the federal government, because somebody in Washington, D.C. is going to tell you what to kill and what you can't kill. And I really appreciated the invitation, and I can go on here, but the time is short, and I'm also chairman of the Fish and Game Advisory Board for Tionic, and I'm also on the General Council. I've got to go to a General Council meeting tomorrow, so thanks for the invitation, and if you have any questions, I'll answer to the best of my ability, because I never had any education.
Mr. Bismarck, thank you for taking the time to come in and testify. We really appreciate it. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Susan Frey.
My name is Suzanne Frey. I'm a resident of Anchorage, and
I apologize.
Okay.
I didn't get
Frey. So
well, I missed it. I mispronounced it all the way around the board, didn't I?
That's okay.
I'm sorry. And who do you represent yourself?
I'm representing just myself.
Fine.
I think of all the things that I've heard so far that make the most sense. First, I want to say that I'm opposed to the Tier 2 subsistence hunting regulations. The things that I've heard so far that make the most sense to me personally was the statement made very early in this meeting by Ron Somerville about tightening up the regulations on what subsistence means. I've been over the past few weeks trying to figure out, what is subsistence? Is it a reality? I've heard so many stories and claims from people who, bush pilots, people who go to the bush regularly, and you hear stories of waste and violation of game regulations that are so awful that it makes you question, what is subsistence? Is that feeding fish to your dogs, and is that more important than someone who lives in Anchorage that's low income, that really needs the fish for the survival of their families? So I see it being a real emotional issue, and I think what people do when issues get very emotional is that they start stereotyping what's happening. And I think some of the stereotypes going on is that when people use the word subsistence, they're assuming that that means someone's survival is dependent on that fish and game. And when you hear stories about waste and violation of the game, it makes you think that they really don't need it for subsistence. So one of the things that I think is real important, the Tier 2 things go into effect, and the whole reason we're having discussion and concern is because that the game is a limited resource. So I think we need to be very sure that all conservation measures are taken, and that the subsistence definition is restricted and limited to people who really do need it just to survive. and that it not be wasted resources and say, well, I'm subsistent, so I can just take whatever I want. I've got no bag limits. I can do whatever I want, and I don't get regulated. The other thing I hear people talking about is a real stereotype, and I think it adds fuel to the fire, of what hunters are like. And I hear statements, I just heard one earlier today, well, I'd rather see rural residents feeding the fish to their dogs than to see big game hunters go in and just take the horns off and waste and just kill the animals because they love to kill animals. And I think there's a real stereotype about hunters that is not true. I have in the past 5 years gone to, I've been a member of the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, and have friends who are hunters and non-hunters alike. And the hunters, I have to say, do the most for conservation that I've seen. They put their money where their mouth is, and they put their time and efforts into conservation. Ducks Unlimited is another good organization. I think people need to keep those things in mind. It's not all hunters are such and such. A lady at a meeting way back was a Native lady, said all Natives are not such and such. That's true. And we need to stay away from the stereotypes and look at the assumptions that we're making and make sure, you know, that we're basing these decisions on what truly the situation is. I think it's very important that all citizens be treated equally, and that there might not be discrimination on who has the privilege or the right to hunt game animals. If laws need to be changed to do that, laws are initially made by legislative bodies and they can be changed by legislative bodies. So I would like to see equality of opportunity for hunting and fishing. And I believe that all citizens should be treated fairly and that no one is above the law. Stories that you hear about how the geese are being endangered in western Alaska because the eggs are being taken out of the nest and they're being killed when they can't even fly, and that this is a violation of the Federal Waterfowl Migratory Bird Act, and that it is not enforced, and that it won't be enforced for certain people, but it is enforced for others, is not fair. And I think it adds fuel to this fire. And so conservation and equal enforcement of the laws is very, very important, and tightening up on the subsistence qualifications. Those are my opinions.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for your testimony. Mr. Kowalski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name, for the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, is Jim Kowalski. That's K-O-W-A-L-S-K-Y. I speak today as chairman of the Rural Alaska Resources Association, or as we refer to it, RARA. That address, by the way, is incorrect that I put on the form there. It should read P.O. Box 3-3908, if you wish to make the correction. That would be the mailing address. Our board of directors is made up of representatives of each of the 10 regional nonprofit Native corporations, and also of the Native village of Tyonek and the North Slope Borough. I am employed by the Tanana Chiefs Conference Incorporated as director of its subsistence program in the interior. RARA is a statewide subsistence advocacy organization which was organized about 10 years ago during the D2 deliberations in Congress. I wish to make one major point, Mr. Chairman, and it is a point which I feel is being missed or which is becoming obscured in the debate, and it is or should be the main consideration of this committee and of the state senate as they consider any legislative amendments to the state subsistence law, and that is that the only thing that really matters in this debate to our Alaskan people who live in the far-flung remote rural communities of our state is that they have the opportunity to feed themselves, their families, and their communities, including the elderly, and those who are handicapped, those who are ill or too young or otherwise unable to hunt or fish. The animals and the fish are the mainstay of the economy of rural Alaska. Harvesting these resources is an economic activity, and it is the only major economic activity, generally speaking, in which rural Alaskan communities have any real confidence. On the other hand, confidence in the cash economy is limited, not strong, not secure. Generally, there is little cash and very few jobs. These, of course, are generalizations, but I believe, in my observation, that they are generalizations which are well-founded. In some communities, there have been, at times, no jobs. Coastal communities, in many cases, have a richer resource base than do the interior communities, and in some cases, may have more seasonal jobs associated with commercial fishing, or perhaps in the timber industry as examples. By contrast, interior communities generally have less resource base with which to work. But in any case, no matter how each of you or others in our urban communities choose to discuss or to debate subsistence solutions, the economic realities for our rural Alaska communities remain a fact of Alaskan life. And I feel that this is a compelling and a major issue in the equation which we all seek. Whatever richness exists out there exists as natural, harvestable, renewable fish and wildlife. And the confidence to harvest these to support human life is the economic base. I should urge you to consider that there is now a sizable body of literature which competently documents these socioeconomic realities of our rural Alaskan communities. I would respectfully like to make several suggestions to the committee, if I may. The first one would be that to pass the governor's proposed amendments to the existing subsistence statute, return the system to what it was last year and years before, several years before that. This was a system perhaps far from being perfect, but it was one which protects the relative handful of rural people who may need the protection this amendment would provide them from time to time as needed, but will also allow Anchorage and other urban hunters to participate in, say, the Nalchina caribou hunt, for example. I should like to depart from what I've written here to mention that Tier 2, as we've come to call it, is perhaps a system that almost everyone I've been in contact with in the last few weeks has learned to love to hate. There's very, very little support for it in the rural sector. Maybe one exception is the village of Nikolai, where for the first time a number of people have been able to get permits to hunt bison there, whereas in the past only one resident in the drawing permit system that existed in the past for the farewell herd was able to get a permit. I might add that that one individual who has a record of hunting was disqualified from the Tier 2 hunt because the post office lost his application for 3 weeks. Secondly, don't put the rural subsistence economy on a lottery or a drawing system. Can you imagine having your own opportunity to actually feed your family and community placed in a drawing or on a system of chance? And thirdly, don't devise legislation which attempts to make subsistence into a welfare system, which would, for example, weed out and prevent specific rural hunters, for example, from engaging in his or her so-called employment, which is a word I choose to use here, just because he might have a cash income which is higher than the median cash income that for that particular community. This hunter, for example, could likely provide, and characteristically could provide, meat for a large family plus elderly people or disabled community residents who may exist in substantial numbers and for whom few or no other reliable sources of meat or fish exist. So let your legislation reflect the fact of rural Alaskan life, which is that communities subsist as communities, but that individuals do not. You might very likely, in other words, disqualify one of the very expert hunters in the community because he may have worked at Prudhoe Bay for 6 or 9 months or so and has a cash income that in this system, you know, of trying to determine as a system that you might come up with that tries to weed out people based on income, you may remove a very valuable hunter from that community. The other thing I would like to say in terms of the welfare system, I feel almost, I certainly feel inadequate following Fred Bismarck because he made the point so well, and that is that he was never on welfare, even after having to leave Anchorage during the Depression. Subsistence is not a welfare system, and I have seen many comments in the newspapers in recent times and also heard a few comments here, including, if I may, sir, mentioned by Mr. Somerville, that would place subsistence at a poverty level. We're talking about an economic system. We're not saying that people have to wait until they're absolutely at some federal poverty guideline before they're going to be able to go out and support themselves. So I think that's a thought that reoccurs with frequency, and I would urge you to think carefully about that. Well, then, to conclude, allow me again to emphasize that differing economic systems must remain a central or anchor point to your deliberations. In terms which may be familiar to us, cash flow, as the term that I wanted to mention here in my summary, in terms of cash flow, the rural communities which I attempted to characterize here generally range from poor to very poor. You know, in measuring relative wealth in terms of cash flow, but in terms of harvest of renewable resources, rural communities are not to be considered as poor. Rather, the consideration should be that the harvest, that is the actual act, the going out and doing it, the harvesting, is the economic activity and it is the economic system of rural Alaska, it is the employment, and I believe that this committee and the Alaska legislature and the administration generally do have an obligation to give this system the protection that is necessary to allow rural communities the confidence and the best opportunity possible to provide for and to help support themselves. As a legislature, I would respectfully remind you that you have gone to enormous and far, far-reaching ends to protect and to foster and to promote the economy and the economic system and opportunities of most other, if not all other, sectors of the Alaskan population. And I feel that you certainly owe that to this economic sector as well. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kowalski. I might pose a question, if I might. You speak of rural. Let me ask you a question, and I'd like to get a yes or no, if you can give it to me.
I'll try.
Is, in your opinion, a rural area within the confines of what you speak of as being rural, Glen Allen, consider your cash economy?
Well, I'm not familiar with Glen Allen, other than the fact
Kotzebue.
That we have a member from the Copper River Native area. I'm not familiar with Glen Allen. I could speak to Tok, which is a similar community.
All right, Tok.
On the road system. Yes, I would say it is rural.
They have hotels, motels, gas stations, grocery stores.
They have several lodges. They have some grocery stores.
Mm-hmm. How about
very, very high prices?
That's not the point.
Well, that is my point.
How about Kotzebue?
Kotzebue, I only know because I've been there, not through my work. I would say Kotzebue is a rural community.
And Kenai?
I couldn't answer about Kenai.
And Cordova?
I don't know.
About Stevens Village?
Oh, yes.
It's rural. I don't think there's a question in anyone's mind that the so-called handful of people that you spoke of will be affected by this one way or another. They certainly have the right to eat. they have a need for it, they have a right to take it, in my opinion. I have trouble personally trying to figure out, in this day and age, in 1985, versus 1948, 950, what is rural and what is urban as our years have gone by. I can remember going down and stopping down in Fish Creek right down there, in right here in Anchorage, with a clothesline and a treble hook, and snagging a fish and taking it home for dinner because I was making $21 a month. It was perfectly all right to do it then, but boy, try it now and they'll hang you. Mr. Kowalski, thank you very much for your input. Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Jim, you said that nobody out there, with one exception, likes Tier 2. Do they dislike the Supreme Court's decision and definition and protection of Tier 2, or do they and Tier 2 is defined in the existing law according to the Supreme Court's decision, or do they dislike the process they currently have to go through to be able to exercise their rights or privileges, whatever it may be, under Tier 2, under the existing law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I feel inadequate to try to represent the views of a lot of people, and I guess I put myself in that position. But to the limits that I have, I can tell you that Tier 2, under the current implementation of Tier 2, which was done in a very hasty fashion, as I'm sure you are aware, has been just a shambles out there. People have been away from communities, from fish camps. I mean, we even went to the Indian Eskimo Olympics to try and pass out Tier 2 permit applications because people are not at home, and to try to get them to meet that deadline. The process is certainly a rigorous one. There have been many, many complaints about it. The $5 fee, for example, is much regretted by virtually everyone that I've talked to, and I have talked to a lot of people in our region, that is in the TCC Doyon region.
Jim, so far as...
That's not a yes or no, yeah, is it?
So far as you know, is there any difference between Tier 2 as defined by the Supreme Court, implementation aside, with subsistence as it was defined before Madison?
I don't think that as we went into subsistence priority before Madison that people in rural communities expected to have to compete in those few cases where there are now Tier 2 hunts with applicants from large communities where there's a very diversified, comparatively very diversified economic opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, I won't pursue this any further now, but I'd sure like to hear from the department about this whole business of the implementation of Tier 2 in the bush at some point.
I wonder if you, Mr. Kowalski, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening.
Commissioner, I wonder, I always believe in striking while the iron is hot, and you're here. Would you care to make any statements or have one of your representatives make any statements regarding Tier 2 in the bush at this time, or would you rather submit it to the committee? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve Behnke.
Maybe how do you spell it, please?
B-E-H-N-K-E, and I'm director of the Division of Subsistence, Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Would you care to answer the question, please?
Senator Fisher, maybe you could repeat the question for me.
You probably heard the testimony just now about the problems encountered in the bush with respect to the implementation of Tier 2. I think references have been made to that before, to the turmoil that's been created. why is it necessary? We didn't, essentially the Supreme Court didn't change anything as to what is now defined as Tier 2. We had that before. Why is all this necessary?
Well, I think the short answer is...
Or what is going on and then why it's necessary?
The short answer is that in the past, if it had been necessary, if there had been such a great demand for specific population in an area where we had a subsistence hunt, we would have had to implement Tier 2 before Madison. The difference was that after Madison, all Alaskans were considered to be in the same situation in terms of subsistence uses, and that meant that the pool of people who qualified for subsistence hunts was much, much extended, much, much expanded. In the past, the only times we would have ever had to have applied Tier 2 would have been in a case... actually, let me give you an example. The Minto moose hunt is a situation where there can only be, I think it's about 15 moose that can be harvested in the Minto management area. There was, in the past, basically those moose were only available to, under the way the board had implemented things before Madison, those moose were basically only available to people who lived in the area. Those were the people who got permits to hunt those moose. After Madison, the board could no longer apply such a restrictive process. They had to go to the situation of basically of ranking all Alaskans who wanted to hunt those moose against all other Alaskans, and that meant that they had to go to this complex application process that the board developed. And of course, the board couldn't look at just the situation in Minto. They had to look at the situation statewide in developing that questionnaire, and there was not time procedurally to try and find ways to accommodate some of the real special characteristics and differences in some rural areas of the state. And that's why there were some real problems in getting applications to people in a timely fashion, getting people to understand the questions, what was required by this new procedure.
You, Mr. Chairman, if I may, you say the board or boards in effect lumped all subsistence users in one pot and then set up criteria. As I read the Madison decision, the court said before this, any occasion to restrict subsistence fishing, in this case, to second-tier preferred subsistence users as distinct from all subsistence users, the board must make two findings. As I understand, the court said there are two tiers. There's Tier 1 and Tier 2. Before you restrict to Tier 2, you have to make these findings. Once you restrict to Tier 2, then it would seem that all Tier 2 subsistence users fall into Tier 2. Why do you have to rank them all on one spectrum?
The distinction... One of the things the board had to do when it looked at these hunts and at implementing the Madison Aluska, the things required by Madison Aluska, was they had to go through and decide which hunts, which species should be considered subsistence species. They went through a process of evaluating each of these hunts, and in cases where, for example, only a limited number of people could be allowed to participate in the hunt, as in the case of the drawing permit hunts, or in the case of limited registration hunts where only a certain number of Alaskans could be allowed to hunt, the Department of Law advised the board that in those cases they were automatically in a Tier 2 situation. And that's the case with Minto, that's the case with Nelchina. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Maybe try it one more time.
Well, I'm beginning to feel there's some real problems with the implementation. Let me ask you a specific question. Why the $5 fee imposed on people who may be in a poverty situation?
Actually, I'm not in a position to answer the question about the $5 fee. I'm not familiar enough with the requirements surrounding the part. But part of that had to do with the fact that we were converting from this permit drawing system to a new system, and the board felt that it really didn't have that it couldn't fiddle around with that. I guess I could also mention, all right, though, that the department was there was a real problem with paying for those things, because we'd obviously been paying for them under a certain system in the past.
I not only question the $5, I question the 25 cents. I think that's ludicrous. I don't know where anybody ever came up with that idea. I probably shouldn't have said that, Commissioner,
Chairman,
I said it anyway.
If Senator Fisher, I'm not sure that I did answer. I think there's a lot more details about why certain things were done that maybe we have time to go into detail here. And I think if that's an area of concern to the committee, I think that we could probably come back with a more detailed explanation of
we'd like to have.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I just a comment. My concern is that some of the implementation has exacerbated the difficulties and the problems that we have, and this makes it that much more difficult right now to move toward a solution, but I won't get on your back.
Thank you very much for helping us out. I note that Mr. Johnson did not put down whether he wanted to testify or whether he didn't. Is Mr. Walter Johnson here? And if he does he wish to testify? Please come up.
Thank you for letting me present. The more I hear, the more pissed I get.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to testify.
May I have your full name and your affiliation, please?
Excuse me?
Your name and affiliation.
Okay, I'm Walter Johnson. I'm representing myself. To me, if a person can afford to fly me out of a remote area, along with the plane fare, and along with the cost of the freight and the and it exceeds, by the time he gets the meat to wherever he is, like you say Anchorage, and he exceeds what he would pay in a supermarket per pound, that is not subsistence. Another part is in this, that SB, which is 320, there's one section, subsection F, that bothers me. It states that a person could not hold both a limited entry permit and a subsistence fishing permit at the same time. I feel that it's just like at a supermarket. If you were to go to the supermarket with a check in your hand, that would be the subsistence fishing permit. And you were to go over to the meat and fish counter and pick, you wouldn't be able to buy them, because that was for permits only, subsistence permits only. And I think that that section there is doing a great injustice to the bush people, rural areas, whatever you want to call it. I just came from, I recall when they used to have open seasons in the Yakutat area, where the moose season would open during our fishing season. We would be fishing instead of hunting. And when we did get to go hunting, we would find carcasses all over. And at this time, it was during the Cordova Airline days and the Pacific Northern Airline days, where they had a chart on the wall which told how many moose were caught each year, and it was anywhere from 350 to 550 fish, moose per year. And it looked like a shotgun had hit that chart with all the pins that they had put in the area. Now, we, at the time, if somebody had gotten a moose, the community would all come and cut a chunk off that moose, whatever they needed. And whenever someone else got one, they would do the same thing. It was a community effort when the moose was caught. Everybody got their share, and whoever got it got the best parts naturally. But, and it continued on throughout the season that way. Now, under the regulation system that when two or three people go out and get a moose, they keep it to themselves because they have to hold on to it for the rest of the year. It ruins the community spirit that was prevalent during the earlier days. Also, one more point that I'd like to make before I close. I see the subsistence hunting in very troubled waters. Everybody is fighting over it, but no one is saying anything about the non-resident or the outside foreign hunters. If there is not enough moose to go around for the Alaskans, why is there non-resident hunting license, or even to allow a foreign person to come in and take the Alaskan moose away from them? This is one thing that I feel should be corrected.
Con Bundy, please. Mr. Bundy? Mr. Bundy had to leave. I note Alma Apikauer. Did I say that right? She's not here. There's Mr. Deal, and he said after 6:30. I presume that'll still hold. Mr. Hendrickson here? Marjorie Russa? Is Marjorie here?
My name is Marjorie Rose, and I'm here just representing myself. Am I too close? Too far?
No, I just pronounced your name wrong.
Well, it has two O's. It's
confusing. I'm sorry.
I came just because I've been concerned about some of the statements that have been made, especially at the Fish and Game Advisory Board meeting the other day. Mr. Jeff Parker at that time said that he had a hard time believing that anyone in Anchorage could claim that they had a subsistence need for the resources in this state. And I disagree with that on a personal basis. My grocery bill is lowered substantially by the meat that comes into my home from these hunts. I figure that I save approximately $1,500 to $2,000 a year just in meat costs for myself and my family, and that I spend approximately $200 to $300 a year on other meats in the store, such as ham and chicken, that I can't go out and hunt or fish. We also hear a lot today about community needs, and I know for myself personally that it is a community action. When one of us is hunting and we are fortunate enough to get an animal or to get a large halibut or to get salmon, we share that resource. And I just want to let you know that I feel that I need protection as an urban resident to have access to some of these resources because it does impact me financially. There are no other local resources for me. I do not qualify for food stamps. I do not want to qualify for food stamps. I don't qualify for moose kill meat off of the Glen Highway. I don't qualify for any other sort of donations, and I don't necessarily want to. I do want to access this natural resource from this state, and that's all I ask, that you try to represent my needs and the needs of other single parents and other residents here who do benefit from the hunting in this state.
Do you do this hunting yourself?
When I can, yes. I do enjoy hunting. And I have been lucky in the past to draw on some good permit hunts for other than subsistence meats. I have gone on the brown bear hunt in Unimak Island and things like that.
Do you eat brown bear?
Once in a lifetime. I tried it once. I didn't like it.
You didn't. So you wouldn't hunt brown bear anymore to eat?
No, I didn't hunt that one to eat. No.
I see.
But I did try it. It saved me substantial amounts of money in my grocery costs. And I don't get a chance to get out of the state of Alaska often. I do enjoy getting out on the hunts. It serves a dual purpose for me. I cannot travel outside the state because of finances. I combine my hunting for food with a vacation. And that makes it a little more reasonable for me.
Mr. Chairman, Suzanne. If it's necessary to choose among hunters as to who gets to hunt this year, would you, given your subsistence need, say that the choice should be made by permit among, let's say, all qualified hunters, qualified in terms of, let's say, resident hunters, or should there be an income criterion applied so that those who, according to income, have the greatest need get the first crack at a permit?
I don't think that you can do it based on income. I don't think that that's a reasonable indicator at all, because my income, even though I live here in Anchorage, is, say, $25,000 a year. You cannot... I don't see how you can determine what the average cost of living for each individual is and how that affects their need for subsistence foods. I would like to see it done equitably. I would like for everyone to have that chance and that opportunity to get out. I can understand what's going on in the villages as far as the fact that, yes, they have traditionally done the hunting, and a lot of it is based, well, their whole economic standard is based around that, and yes, they do need to also be able to hunt. But I think before we start restricting everyone and before we even attempt to start imposing financial guidelines on this, we need to check into the abuses and we need to check into actual needs for what is happening in the villages.
When I posed the question, I really wasn't juxtaposing you versus somebody in the village, in an isolated village. I was thinking more in terms of urban hunters. Thank you.
I would be satisfied with the lottery again.
Drawing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. You. Evelyn Pete.
I'm the first baby born in Glen Allen, Alaska.
Back off just a little bit.
Okay.
Back off a little more.
Okay.
Back off some more. Get away from the mic a little bit more.
Okay.
Try that.
Okay. I am the first baby born in Glen Allen, Alaska, 1946, April 1st. And later I'll get to your motels and hotels thing. Okay. The state of Alaska, Mr. Abood.
Yes, ma'am.
Has no jurisdiction.
Pardon?
Has no jurisdiction in this matter, in subsistence, or any other issue that should be handled by the villages. Each village has plenary power over any activity on their land. according to federal law. If the state of Alaska wants to regulate food, it should do so in its reservations of Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. You should be alarmed now because you ship all of your food from Western America. What will you do when a natural disaster occurs? We have told you repeatedly to use the lowlands and Anchorage and Juneau and Fairbanks to grow your food and animals, and use the highlands for your homes. Since I don't recognize the state of Alaska and its state-chartered entities, AFN, City of Anchorage, Municipality of Anchorage, all the boroughs, because according to federal law, they're third-party trespass of my rights as a villager from the native village of Chitnan Tonsina. I've told my people to hunt and fish and gather food as usual. On your thing about the rural situation in Glen Allen, who owns those hotels, motels, gas stations, grocery stores? Atna Incorporated owns one lodge up there and a construction company, but that is a state-chartered entity. As an individual Native person, and as many of our people, we don't have access to these financial institutions. And this, not only since you don't have any jurisdiction over this matter to us, we can't be included in these roles that you're doing. We will continue to hunt. We will continue to fish. I have four sons, all of whom I'm raising to be hunters. This isn't a lifestyle. This is my life. It's not my lifestyle. This is my family's life. This is my ancestors' life. Now, I know you did a lot of work with this. You know, and I know that you're in a touchy situation. But the real thing here is that in the rural villages, you have no jurisdiction on these matters at all. You can't come in and tell us how many animals to catch, how many birds to catch. You can't tell us anything like that, how many whales to catch. This is not your issue, and you should be concerned about feeding your people. Thank you.
Thank you. Shellen Ketchanag. Did I make it that time?
Excuse me. Yes. My name is Sheldon Ketchatag, last name spelled K-A-T-C-H-A-T-A-G. Mr. Chairman and Senator Fisher, I come here representing the United Tribes of Alaska, which is a coalition of sovereign tribal governments which have gotten together to respond to an ever-increasing threat, not only to our way of life and our resources, but also to increasing encroachments into governmental functions which we as Native people have held in reserve for ourselves. I'm not sure if you've heard recently, but the Native village of Unalakleet has made known to the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee of the Congress of the United States our intent not only to declare our sovereignty over all lands and resources, waters, and property within our traditional tribal boundaries, but also that we will be unfurling our sovereign immunity over all lands, waters, resources, and property within said boundaries. It's taken our people an awful long time to realize the true intent of the Western society with regard not only to our people, but also to our lands, waters, and resources. And it has come time for our people to stand up and say enough is enough. We cannot afford either Washington, D.C. regulating our resources. We also cannot afford Juneau regulating our resources. Our people have husbanded, have managed, have used, and have lived in harmony with our resources since time immemorial, and I think that all of your archaeological people will attest to that fact. The United States of America was founded on the principle that we cannot be taxed, we cannot be governed by a body which is not only far removed from ourselves, but also we cannot afford to be governed by a government and taxed by a government, which in fact does not represent our people. And it is in this regard that I would like to inform your committee, Mr. Chairman, of hearings to be held in Unalakleet on the 10th of September, 1985, for the purposes of not only hearing testimony with regard to this declaration of sovereign jurisdiction by the native village of Unalakleet, but also to the finalization of this declaration. We cannot afford social experiments anymore. Time and time again, we have heard that the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act and all acts succeeding it are in fact part of a social experiment on the part of the federal government to redefine the relationships between the federal government and our native people. Looking back over the last 30 years, and more importantly over the last 26 years since Alaska became a state, our people have been inundated by a geometrically increasing amount of paperwork with regard to our resources. We cannot afford to take the time or the effort away from our subsistence economic activities to be in compliance with all of these regulations, statutes, laws that have been passed by other governments. I have made the point time and time again that the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, as passed by Congress on 17th of December 1971, is in fact a genocidal act. And we will be asking at our second annual Congress, the 15th through the 21st of September, here in Anchorage, that we will be seeking relief from not only this genocidal act, but also all other acts which we feel to be genocidal, not only to those born before December 18, 1971, but also to those born after December 18, 1971. And I would just like to point out that the native village of Unalakleet, as I said, we cannot afford to wade through and comply with all the paperwork which has been passed down, not only by the state of Alaska, but also by all the departments and agencies and bureaus of the federal government regarding our resources. And therefore, we decided that it's time now for us as a separate and distinct people to stand behind our tribal governments, which have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government, to put an end to this paperwork. We do not wish to be labeled outlaws because we cannot take the time to comply with this multitude of paper. We are not a paper-related society. We are not a paper-related people. I think there was a reason down through the centuries why our people did not develop a written language. Because when you begin to deal with paper, you also begin to deal with corporations, limited liability corporations, limited liability government. And our people could not afford that because we devote too great of our time to our survival as a people. And even now, if you talk to 80% of the villagers in what you call Bush, Alaska, you will find that if you would research their activities with regard to their resources out there, that I could guarantee you that you would find each and every one of them in violation of some law or another. And I think it's time for our people to decide for themselves who in fact is the master that they will serve. Are they going to be bound by laws passed by people who live in Anchorage and pass laws in Juneau, or are they going to be bound by laws passed by Congress in Washington, D.C., or do they in fact wish to be bound by laws and regulations of their own peers, their own friends, their own family? And I think it's time that this is brought to the head. I have gotten into this arena, if you will, for the primary purpose of clarifying the position, not only of myself as an individual, but of our people, not only with regard to the state of Alaska, but also with regard to the federal government. I see this declaration on the part of the native village of Unalakleet as very necessary because the federal government has abrogated its responsibilities, which they assumed due to the adoption of the Treaty of Sessions in 1867. They assumed responsibilities for lands, lands protection, waters, waters protection, resources, education, educational services, health and medical services for our people for all time. Because of the discovery of oil in 1968, the multinational corporations pressured Congress into passing the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act upon our people without our consent.
Mr. Kachetan.
Yes.
In that you don't want to, and your people don't want to abide by our laws, and you don't have time enough to abide by our laws of the United States or the federal government, and you wish to go on your own hook, then you take this up with the federal government. This committee is not going to sit here and listen to this type of conversation because we have nothing to do with it. This is subsistence under the laws that we live on. If those laws cannot be implemented in your area, then that's your problem. That's not ours.
That's
and
right.
Therefore, I would ask you to conclude your testimony because this is not the place for this type of a format.
I fully concur with what you say, Chairman Aboud, and I would just like to close by saying that the state of Alaska, through its constitution, has disclaimed jurisdiction as far as our subsistence resources are concerned.
Thank you for your testimony. I note that Mr. Lohr from Rural Cap did not put down whether he wanted to speak or not. Does he or not? Fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Hunter?
Mr. Chairman, I wish to thank both of you for coming to the meeting here and taking time for public input to this crucial issue.
Name and affiliation, please.
I'm Bob Hunter from the Alaska Sport Fishing Association, representing the association. Once the legal interpretation of the 1978 subsistence law was forced, the boards of Fish and Game had no alternative but to adjust regulations and allocations according to existing law. Only now is the public beginning to understand what we were trying to explain in 1981. Even now, as in 1981, the governor and AFN via Janie Leask are attempting to publicize articles in local papers to cloud the real issues the subsistence priority creates. The very nature of a priority designation creates a class system or Alaska's own apartheid laws. Hunters and fishermen alike recognize that in all cases there is insufficient fish and wildlife resources for everyone to take what they want. We do, however, wish to have an equal and fair chance just for the opportunity to take fish and game. Yet, even with that statement, we are willing to recognize that it is still possible in this vast state to allow exceptions to this equal opportunity to prevent those in very remote rural areas not yet affected by the rapid population expansion to harvest fish and game on a limited need for survival basis. During the 1985 legislative session, Governor Sheffield introduced Don Mitchell's subsistence bill entitled House Bill 288. Not only was there insufficient time for public understanding and input, but the bill would simply have ensured that all rural Alaskans have priority in taking fish and game a public resource. That is why we ask that the bill not be passed, or at best pass it with a one-year sunset clause. Fortunately, it was not passed. Since AFN was successful in obtaining a federal law that finally included subsistence wording in ANILCA, we are now faced with an even less understood federal law and intervention situation. In summary, we have a very unfair, unconstitutional mess in our hands. Alaska is a very dynamic and growing state. People are drawn here for numerous reasons besides jobs, and one of those major reasons is the hunting and fishing opportunities. The existence of a subsistence law as exists today, or as proposed by the governor, will seriously affect an individual's desire to stay in such a prejudicial and corrupt climate. The tourism industry, both in hunting and fishing, will be drastically affected. Not all of this will happen overnight. It will take years. But as individuals are excluded from sport hunting and fishing, they will apply for subsistence permits. In a relatively short number of years, it will all be subsistence fishing and hunting to the detriment of sport and commercial operations. Currently, we have land still being given away by the state for settling 2, 5, 40, or even 160-acre tracts of land still do not necessarily raise the moose, caribou, salmon, and other needs of an individual that moves there to live on the land. Yet rural preference would give the lucky winner of a lottery preference for all time to fish and game resources. Rural in itself is not the answer, and we cannot go for a short-term solution to this subsistence mess. We are willing to recognize limited subsistence needs of an extremely limited, very few remote individuals, but we will also state that we will not accept a priority subsistence right to an individual or family that has chosen the remote living over urban living as a way of life and expects all urban residents to give up their rights to a common resource. Neither do we recognize individuals or families taking part in the commercial activities commonly associated with Alaska's business or industrial expansion as having a priority right to suddenly claim subsistence needs and priority. Cook Inlet and its surrounding relatively densely populated area is an excellent example of an area where subsistence priority for any resource must be very rare. You simply can no longer support that type of living, no matter how desirable. What all this adds up to is the fact that the Boards of Fish and Game were doing an excellent job in accounting for true subsistence needs prior to the imposition of the literal translation of the law. We are therefore providing 11 points that we feel are necessary for consideration and inclusion in any amendment to the 1978 subsistence law. These points, in effect, will enable the Boards of Fish and Game to an equitable allocation of the resources. We hope that these points will be incorporated in a Senate Bill 320 or other appropriate legislation. All points are important. The first 5 points that we have enumerated have been modified in discussions with the Alaska Outdoor Council and has been presented to you by Ron Somerville, as I understand, and I will not go over those. We do agree with their position. The sixth point that we had was subsistence harvest should be based on meeting the protein needs and, in some cases, significant cultural needs of the harvesters. One species should be substitutable for another comparable species, and harvest should occur on those species that are most abundant and best able to withstand the harvest. It is asinine to have subsistence fishing on king salmon in the Kenai River when you have hundreds of thousands of red salmon coming into that. We have background data that we are providing. I will, in the interest of brevity, skip those, that if you desire.
Thank you.
Certain areas exist where the fishery resource are so sensitive that the efficient harvest methods associated with subsistence fishing, gill nets, would destroy those resources in a short period of time. 1 year would wipe it out. The Board of Fisheries must continue to have the authority upon a formal finding of fact to close such areas to subsistence fishing while still allowing less efficient methods such as pole and line. The definition of subsistence gear is proper and should not be amended. The definition does not normally allow pole and line to be as used as a subsistence gear. That is currently being used as a thinly veiled operation in an attempt to gain a priority over commercial fishermen, and I think the boards of fish and game are the appropriate place for that type of a battle. A set of personal use fishing regulations is needed to allow the harvest of fish where they occur in numbers excess to escapement and commercial and consumptive needs. Fishing regulation, personal use. This should be and end up probably in a way where the board is just authorized to establish a personal use category if they so desire. It need not be something that's in the law. Rainbow and steelhead trout should not be subject to a subsistence priority. The Board of Fisheries shall continue to have the authority to allocate the harvest of these species to any user group without priority on a case-by-case basis. And that, again, is you can wipe those out overnight. And subsistence fishing in Cook Inlet waters should be limited to the areas adjacent to English Bay, Port Graham, and Tyonek, as previously designated by the Board of Fisheries. All other non-commercial net fishing in Cook Inlet should be conducted under personal use regulations. In effect, on the last comment, if the law is written correctly, Cook Inlet would be eliminated with the exception of those 3 points anyway. Do you have any questions?
No, but I surely want a copy of that submitted for the record. Mr. Hunter, thank you very much for your testimony. If you'd please give us a copy of that. I see we have representatives of Rural Cap also. Do you all speak together or one at a time or for the group or what? Will this be in lieu of Mr. Lure?
This would be as an individual because I had no intentions of testifying, but after listening to things, I just want to give
okay.
my 2 bits.
Why don't you go ahead, your name and affiliation.
Okay. My name is Janine Kennedy, and though I do work at Rural Cap, let's see, this is totally as an individual, okay? Because even though I work there, I don't keep up with what's happening in the subsistence business. I'm doing other things. And I guess just after listening to all this, you know, it's like I'm going to have to speak from my heart, okay, because I wrote down a few notes, but I don't have anything prepared. But as I see the issue, it's like there's a certain amount of resources. And there's people coming in and they're saying, we have the right, you know, to share what you people have. And the people in the rural areas are saying, well, you know, we would like to share, but we want to make sure that we can use our resources. And this is my, and all I see too or hear is that there's concern for the there's concern for the legal aspects, there's concern for the economic aspects. And there's all these concerns, and my concern is the spiritual concern. It's like Sheldon was up here, and he was going on and on about historical right or something, and my observation when I just heard this man's talk, you know, he said, one of the things that attracted us to Alaska was that we could hunt and fish. And the thing that came into my mind was, because you messed up yours so bad in 200 years that you want to come up here and mess it up too. You know, the natives up here have been taking care of the land for 30,000 years. And, you know, he said if you use subsistence practices in 1 year, it would be totally wiped out. Well, the way I look at it is, how come they did it for so many thousands of years and they took very good care of the land? It's like they are the tenders of the land. And when people come in and they say, you're talking wrong, you have the wrong religion, you have the wrong way to think and be, you must do it this way because this is better. And people always say, well, you know, that they don't know anything. But I'm saying that maybe we ought to listen to those people. We really ought to listen. All our values and systems. I mean, here we have all these regulations, and it's a mess. I mean, you can't implement it. You can't control it. You can't use it. It's not producing the results that you want. What is the value of that? And the native values, you know, they've been time-tested for thousands of years. Our values in the Western mode of greed, of competition, and all these things, they have not worked. They are not working. They create a lot of problems. And so my testimony is simply to say, you know, maybe we should listen to what they're saying. They might have something to say. You might have something to learn.
Janine, thank you very much. We also have Terry Gottstein. Is she here also? Mr. Ostrowski? All right, hold it just a second. You, Terry Gottstein? Okay, you're going to speak for Rural Cap?
No, I'm speaking
for Rural Cap. Okay. Would you come up?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Hi. My name is Terry, for the record, my name is Terry Gottstein, and I'm testifying on my own behalf today. The reason I came down today is I've been rather distressed by a lot of the accounts in the newspapers, and I don't know if it's the fault of the media or whose fault it is, but it seems to me that most of the play that's been the press has been giving to this issue has been that non-native people in Anchorage, this is the way I feel the issue has been characterized, and so I felt obligated to come and speak out. Basically, it's been characterized that most of the non-native people in Anchorage are opposed to the subsistence priority. And I personally feel very strongly, it's hard for me to see why subsistence users should not be given priority. To me, it's basic common sense that if someone is dependent on a resource for their food and their very just basic sustenance, that they should be given priority. When I talk to people about outside about this issue, they are, frankly, confused as to why it would even be an issue. It's basic common sense that if someone is dependent on a resource, they should be given a priority. And I'm more than a little bit annoyed with the Senate for not taking action last session on this issue and for sitting on it when all of this hoopla could have easily been avoided just by amending the law to reflect the original intent of the law, which is that subsistence users be given the priority. And just because the play has been given in the press that all the mostly non-native people in Anchorage are opposed to the subsistence priority, I, as an Anchorage resident, I felt obligated to come down and say that there are some of us who do not feel that way. We may not come out in the press and scream and yell and jump up and down about the way we feel, but there are quite a lot of us who support the subsistence priority, and that's why I came out to testify today.
Thank you. I don't think you'll find anyone in the legislature that does not support subsistence either. You should know that. We're not against it. The Senate's not against it. I'm not against it. No one in my acquaintances are against subsistence for those that need it.
Uh-huh.
I hope you understand that.
Well, since I have this opportunity to ask you face-to-face, Senator Abboud, I'm curious to know why you did sit on the legislation.
Because it was a bad bill. Because it wouldn't have done a thing for us. And if you get into it a little deeper, you'll understand why. And the issue now is not whether I held it or not. The issue is to solve the problem. Do you have a solution for us? Perhaps you could help us with the solution.
Well, I assumed that that was your job and that it was supposed
that's
to be
true,
done within
that's
the
what
120-day
these
limit.
Are, that's what these hearings are for, to take input, to help us with the solution. We need your help. Our IQ didn't go up 400% when we got elected.
That's obvious.
That's very true, too. So thank you for your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Chairman.
Yes.
I would just like to add to what you said about how senators feel. Insofar as testimony here today has been concerned, there have been some people who have said, a few people have said, rural subsistence users should not have a priority over urban subsistence users. On the other hand, there have been quite a number of representatives of organizations and individuals who have acknowledged that there is a special need out there, and they have not there has not been any kind of an overwhelming response, at least so far at this mm-hmm. hearing, as I hear it, against subsistence and against needed bush subsistence.
Mm-hmm. What you said about that no one is against subsistence priority for those that need it, I hope that when you're weighing out those that need it, you weigh the difference that subsistence plays in a rural lifestyle that it does in an urban lifestyle. I mean, I'm not saying that people shouldn't, you know, a lot of people moved up here because of the resources and they want to have the right to hunt and all that. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have the right to do that. I just think that it should really be taken into consideration the role that that plays in a rural lifestyle versus an urban lifestyle. I mean, to me, the most urban hunters, for them, that's something they do out of choice. It's not something they have to do. And I hope that that's reflected in your deliberations.
It would be helpful if you could figure out what need is in the rural areas and give us an idea how we decide and figure out what a need is for subsistence. No one has yet defined subsistence that I know of. It'd be nice to have someone give us the answers. Because if we had it, we
wouldn't
be sitting.
Well, I'm an urban resident, and so I'm not exactly the appropriate person to define what subsistence is for a rural resident. You might ask some of those rural residents.
I see. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Ostrowski, we now have 25 minutes to 5. We're coming back again at 7. So if you could, we'd like to get back and have some dinner and so on before we go till late tonight. So I'd appreciate your comments to be held down to it. Reasonable amount, if you will, Hank.
Chairman Abboud and minority member of the House Affairs.
gave you that impression. I'm sorry.
Yes. Okay, then what I'd like to say, since this is, it looks to me, is nothing but a publicity ploy in their sense. There's only
You're absolutely wrong.
Two members
Ostrowski,
here on this
committee.
Mr. Ostrowski,
I'm going to call you out of order. Called you out of order, Mr. Ostrowski, and I expect you to respect it.
I don't respect this committee because there are only two members here, and you are nothing more than a political, making political allegations.
Senator Abood, my name is Tim Stevens. I'm the chairman of the Anchorage Fish and Game Advisory Committee. I've been on that committee for 8 years now. This is my second term as chairman, albeit not my choice. We held a special meeting, as you know, last week, August 19th, 7 p.m. at East High School, and we thank you for your attendance at that meeting. I'd hope to see a little better crowd turnout and support, hopefully, in later sessions they'll arrive. There were approximately 150 people at that meeting. The consensus of the opinion, literally the unanimous consensus of opinion, after 4 hours of testimony, was that Tier 2 subsistence hunts, as they are now to be conducted in 1985, are a sham. They should not be allowed to be held. I have here a document that I'll give you as a matter of record, the minutes of the meeting. There's two documents. One, the minutes of the meeting, and two, a document that we sent to Commissioner Collingsworth, which we have not received a reply yet, asking for an immediate emergency closure of all Tier 2 subsistence hunts that come within the jurisdiction of the Anchorage Fish and Game Advisory Committee, not all Tier 2 hunts in the state, because we don't have jurisdiction over a lot of them and a lot of the remote rural areas, and we shouldn't. But those which touch upon us and touch upon the majority of the rural residents, the urban residents, we advised immediate closure due to the fact that all people were not represented. It's also a best use for the most people for the longest period of time definition of conservation. And that's the basic reason we asked for the closure. It's not in the best interests for the best use for the most people over the longest period of time. As a matter of fact, these Tier 2 hunts created a perfect paradox. I'll quote you, I'll give you several examples. First, probably most prevalent misunderstanding and misuse by the Board of Game when they created the Tier 2 hunts